From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Gelton, and this is On Point. An election upset in Alabama this week when Democrat Doug Jones cinched a landmark victory in Tuesday's Senate election.
At the end of the day, this entire race has been about dignity and respect.
Even with the Republican tax bill on unsteady ground, President Trump was confident it would pass.
I think we will get there. It'll be in a very short period of time. It will be the greatest Christmas present that a lot of people have ever received.
And a homemade explosive went off in New York's Port Authority during rush hour Monday morning. CBS News reported the blast.
We have breaking news here in New York City. Police have evacuated the city's main bus terminal in Midtown Manhattan because of an explosion.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Karen Tumulty, Molly Ball, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join us on air or online. What do you see in the election victory of Doug Jones? Do you see a broader shift in our nation's politics? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining us now from Washington is Karen Tumulty, national political correspondent for The Washington Post. Karen, terrific to have you with us. Hello.
Great to be here.
And also from Washington, Molly Ball, national political correspondent for Time Magazine. Molly, thanks to you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, our own Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Molly, and Karen.
Okay. Molly, I have to start with you because you were in Birmingham. First of all, tell us a little bit about Doug Jones. I mean, what's it like to be a Democratic candidate in such a deep red state when you launch your campaign? I can't believe you really have any expectation that you're going to win.
Well, I asked Doug Jones exactly that question when I interviewed him. A lot of times in these deep red states, if there's a Democratic candidate at all, and in fact, the last time this Senate seat was up, there was no Democratic candidate. Jeff Sessions ran unopposed. But if there's a Democratic candidate at all, it tends to be sort of a sacrificial lamb, someone who doesn't mind just sticking their name on the ballot and losing and sort of being a good soldier just so the party has someone in place. The reason, though, you want someone with at least a little bit of credibility in that slot is something can happen. A scandal, for example, can come out about a Republican nominee who's already quite flawed, and suddenly it becomes a competitive race. Now, Doug Jones is rather well-credentialed. He is a well-respected former U.S. attorney, best known for having prosecuted, after nearly 40 years, the case of the Birmingham church bombing that killed four little black girls in 1963. And he told me that he felt like Democrats in Alabama were due for a comeback and that he was tired of being a Democrat in Alabama and seeing the party never able to compete, seeing it never able to make an effort and try to activate more people. And with the election of Donald Trump and with a lot of other state-level political scandals that have been happening in Alabama, he felt like maybe the winds of change were blowing. Maybe people in Alabama were ready to go in a new direction. So he firmly believes that even if the scandal involving Moore had not come out, that he still would have had a chance and he still was going to make a campaign of it.
That's really interesting. Karen, we need to talk, we could talk all hour about the political ramifications of this election, but let's just zero in on one question, and that is the future of Steve Bannon. Now, Steve Bannon encouraged Trump to campaign for Roy Moore. What has this done to his reputation and to sort of the political strategy that he represented?
Hello?
Karen, did you hear that question? Okay, well, we're having a little trouble connecting with Karen. So, Jack Beatty, how about that question for you? What does this mean for Steve Bannon and his future?
Well, it looks bad. He backed the wrong horse, and he lost, and he came in for some barbed, satirical criticism from other Republicans. Peter King of New York talked about looked like some homeless person on the stage there, and in Alabama, you know, with his two shirts and his. Beard, but his whole theory of, you know, sort of we'll campaign against these establishment Republicans will put people in who represent Trumpism. That will win. That received a decisive rebuff. And other, you know, people say he may have better pickings elsewhere, but I'm sure that Mitch McConnell and the Senate Republicans were very happy to see him lose here. And apparently, he's lost cast with the president. The president believes he gave him that Bannon gave him bad advice to back to back Moore.
Well, if there's anything that Donald Trump doesn't like, it's a loser, right? We're going to try and get Karen Tumulty back, but meanwhile, back to you, Molly Ball. Obviously, the big issue here was the sexual harassment allegations against Roy Moore and the Me Too movement and the reckoning that followed. I'm curious about one thing. The polls weren't exactly right in calling this. Everyone thought that Roy Moore, it seems like most of the pollsters thought Roy Moore was going to pull this out. Do we know whether Alabama women did not tell pollsters or perhaps even their own husbands who they were voting for and that there was sort of maybe a secret women's surge for Doug Jones? Do we know anything about that?
Well, we certainly know, according to the exit polls, that Doug Jones won women by a wide margin. I believe he won women overall by 16 points, and there was about a 30-point gap between the men's vote and the women's vote, one of the largest ever seen. So, you know, I do think that women voters were key to this election, particularly African-American women, and women voters are going to be the key to 2018. We are already seeing women have been the backbone of the resistance to Trump. They have been mobilizing in historic numbers as part of the anti-Trump activism that has arisen from the Women's March to the Women's Convention to record numbers of women candidates and women organizers all over the country. I went out canvassing in Alabama with a woman who runs the local Indivisible group in Birmingham, and she told me that you know, she thought she was the only progressive in Alabama until she started organizing and met all these other people who thought like her. And now this group has 2,000 members. Now, Birmingham's a liberal city, but you're seeing in even deep red places, these progressives are finding each other and they're saying we can't sit on the sidelines any longer. And I think women are largely driving that. Now, we don't know your question about the polls. You know, the polls are all over the place. It's very difficult to determine who is going to vote in a special election. One thing that pollsters didn't know how to gauge was a lot of people, the electorate, a lot of people were saying they're going to vote that according to the pollsters' algorithm didn't seem like they were going to vote, right? According to the way they tend to predict these things, you were seeing Democrats saying, we really, really want to vote. We're really determined. And Republicans saying, we're not sure. And if they've always voted in the past, pollster doesn't know how to rate that. It turned out the Democrats were telling the truth. The Democratic turnout disparity with the Republicans was really stark. You know, the Republican campaign, Roy Moore's campaign, actually got more than the number of votes that they thought that they needed in order to win. But they were swamped by this incredible surge in Democratic votes all over the state, where these, the cities, the suburbs where there are a lot of Republicans who are disillusioned with Trump and with the Republican Party, and the African-American areas in the state really turned out at mind-boggling numbers for a special election in the middle of December.
Okay. You know, before we go on, we should point out that Roy Moore has actually refused to concede this election in spite of his own Secretary of State saying it appears that Doug Jones won. In a video that Moore released on Wednesday, he declared he's waiting for the official vote count. Here's a clip of him detailing what he thinks has gone wrong in the United States.
We have stopped prayer in schools. We've murdered over 60 million of our unborn children. We've redefined marriage and destroyed the basis of family, which is the building block of our country. Our borders are not secure. Our economy is faltering under an enormous national debt. And we have a huge drug problem. We've even begun to recognize the right of a man to claim to be a woman and vice versa.
And I think we've got Karen Tumulty back with us again, and I'm really glad for that, Karen, because I want your contribution.
I don't know what happened there.
Well, it sometimes happens. We're all over the place. So we've been talking about we can't move on from the Alabama election until we get your take on it. What we've talked about the role of women and black voters. I don't know if you've been able to follow our conversation, but
to you, what is the single – I mean, we just heard this clip from Roy Moore in which he outlined all the issues that Donald Trump has really put to the forefront. Are those issues gone now?
I think that, you know, that the Alabama experience was so unique that it – you know, it's – I think we should resist the temptation to apply it many other places. But one thing it does show is kind of the limitations of Trump-style politics. I talked to – on election night, Taylor Branch, who has written so many wonderful books about the civil rights era. And he had said that, you know, obstructionist politics under Trump has sort of been reduced to having to be explicitly backward and tribal. And really, the fact that this did not work for Roy Moore, did not pull him out of a jam after these allegations surfaced, suggests that, you know, this Trump-style politics, this tribalism, has its limits as we go into the midterm election year.
But I'm still wondering whether, you know, whether there is a difference between style and policy issues here, and whether sort of a Republican candidate can sort of run on these same issues in a sort of a less obstreperous sort of way.
I think that it's – yes, of course. And that is in a lot of ways where their base is right now. But the fact is that you have to face forward when you do this. You have to be moving ahead. And I just think the sort of rejection of modernity that we saw in Alabama is, you know, is – as we saw, has its limits.
This is On Point. I'm Tom Gelton. We're talking about the week's news. You can join our conversation. Do you see progress in the Russia investigation? What about President Trump's refusal to accept intelligence on Russia's involvement in swaying the election? Follow us on Twitter, and you can find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. And we're talking about the week's top stories with Karen Tumulty of The Washington Post, Molly Ball of Time Magazine, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. And Jack, let's start looking ahead from Alabama. Of course, the results in Alabama followed the results in Virginia and New Jersey, where Democrats also scored big and, to an extent, unexpectedly big results. Is it too soon for Democrats to think that they're really – that the tide has turned? And as Karen suggested just before the break, that maybe we're at a turning point in politics. Looking – is our prospects for Democrats that much better, do you think?
Well, Alan Abramovitz, the political scientist this week, pointed to signs of what he calls a Democratic wave building. First of all, there's the 15-point difference in the generic Republican congressional ballot. Are you for a Republican or a Democrat, without mentioning names? That's quite high, and indeed almost unprecedentedly high. Then there's President Trump's approval rating, which in one recent poll is 32%, 49% favor impeaching him, 70% in a recent poll want the sex charges against him investigated by Congress. All these things, especially the president's unpopularity, point to a real bad election scenario for the Republicans. They say that any time a president is beneath 50%, that's bad for his party. When he's at 32, the party is in bad shape. Now, of course, the 2010 redistricting made much of the House immune to even the highest wave, you might think, but you can never tell. And people say that the Senate doesn't look like it's in play, but again, you can't tell about that. But at least at this point, the Democrats can point to things that say this is a reaction is building. And of course, it's all part of the pattern of American politics. In their classic book of the 50s, The American Voter, the authors say surge and decline. That's the basic. President surges in the election year, declines in the off year.
Let's look at a tweet from Michael Gerson. Michael Gerson, of course, was a speechwriter for George W. Bush, a longtime Republican. He has really emerged as one of the leading conservative critics of Donald Trump and of the Trumpism style. He wrote this week, if Republicans lose, and I think he's talking here about 2018, Trump's Republican opponents will not be to blame. It would be Trump and his supporters who turned the Republican Party into a sleazy, derelict funhouse, unsafe for children, women, and minorities. Molly Ball, Donald Trump, as his style, did not really accept responsibility for the outcome in Alabama. In fact, he said that he pointed out that he didn't support Roy Moore in the beginning, and maybe if more people, he suggests that if more people listened to him, they would do better, it seems, right?
Well, of course, he did. He tried to avoid responsibility, but this is actually the third election in a row in the space of just a couple of months where the candidate endorsed by Trump and promoted by Trump and pushed by Trump has not crossed the finish line. So, you know, you had Trump was for Luther Strange in the Alabama primary, tweeted a lot for Strange, lent his support, recorded campaign messages for him. And even in a Republican primary where Trump is relatively popular among the Republican base, the voters weren't interested in what he had to say, and they chose Roy Moore. And then in the Virginia elections that you referred to, Trump was not asked to come campaign for the Republican nominee, Ed Gillespie. But he did tweet repeatedly in support of Ed Gillespie, and the campaign did highlight that to the supporters with whom they thought it would be effective. And Ed Gillespie lost that race in Virginia, which admittedly is trending blue, but he lost it by 9 points, which is right, more than the margin by which Donald Trump lost that state a year ago. And then you have Alabama, where Trump's candidate didn't win. And I think the important thing is, you know, as you mentioned, Trump is not on the ballot next year. But what we're seeing in all these elections is not only does Trump support not help the Republican candidate, it actually may be a weight around their neck because Trump is motivating Democrats. He's motivating Democrats to come out and send a message about what they think of him. And so you are seeing, Trump is having an effect in these elections, but it's not an advantage for his side.
Karen Tumulty?
I think there's another factor at work here, too, in favor of the Democrats. And I'm old-fashioned enough to think that candidate quality matters. And, Democratic candidates, potential candidates around the country are going to see these races and sense opportunities. And we've also seen a lot of Republican retirements. And so I think that as a result, you're going to get a lot closer races in some places that you might not have had otherwise just because high-quality candidates are going to be think that these are real opportunities.
And meanwhile, in the aftermath of this election, President Trump took on Democratic Senator Kirsten Gillibrand, saying that she would do anything for a campaign contribution. She immediately fired back in a press conference. She called his insult a sexist smear, and she referenced a Monday press conference by women who have accused Trump himself of sexual misconduct.
It was a sexist smear attempting to silence my voice, and I will not be silenced on this issue. Neither will the women who stood up to the president yesterday, and neither will the millions of women who have been marching since the Women's March to stand up against policies they do not agree with.
What do you think, Jack Beatty? Do you think that the consequence here will be that President Trump will have to answer for some of the accusations against himself as we go forward?
Well, I think 100 Democratic House members and senators have said he should resign. There have been calls for an investigation. And there is in the New York system a suit proceeding that could have that might require him to give a deposition about on the question of whether he defamed one of his accusers, and beyond that, you know, his reaction to the Monday press conference of these women was to say, "I don't know any of these people. I've never met them." That's a demonstrable falsehood. There are photographs of him with various women, and of course that pattern of just lying when in doubt is almost defining now of this presidency. In their very strict sort of algorithm of deception, the New York Times gets him to 100-plus lies. The Washington Post, with a much more, you know, inaccuracies and so on, they get them to a 1,000. But whatever it is, it is, you know, and the Times finds Obama over 8 years that they had 18 lies, and that Obama had a tendency to correct what he said when facts emerged that were discrepant with it. So the president, I think, went right to his character, which is, when in doubt, I will make something up about these women.
Well, of course, one of the issues that has really emerged this year is the standing of mainstream news organizations like the New York Times, like the Washington Post, and it remains to be seen whether even doing articles like that is going to change very many people's perceptions of the candidates. Let's go now to David, a listener from New Orleans, Louisiana. David, you're on Point. Thanks for calling.
Hey, Tom. How are you doing?
I'm good. Thank you.
I live in New Orleans, but I grew up in Alabama for the first 24 years of my life in Tuscaloosa. And I was listening to the panel just a few minutes ago, and it dawned on me as you were playing that replay of Roy Moore's sort of manifesto of what's wrong with America right now.
Yeah.
That, you know, absent the allegations, the accusations of child molestation and whatnot, I think Roy Moore would have won hands down in Alabama. Unfortunately, I'm not a Roy Moore fan by any means, but I also think a candidate equivalent to him would have probably won a similar election in any state that probably went pretty heavy Trump in last year's general election. So I think, I just wanted to offer up to the panel and the audience that the idea that, you know, I think Roy Moore's loss was less about the demise of President Trump politically, and much more but just about the unique situation that Roy Moore was in.
Well, maybe Democrats should consider this as, not get carried away with this idea, this is a major turning point. Molly Ball, you were there. What do you think? Do you think that a sort of a more conventional, slightly less outrageous Republican candidate would have won handily?
I don't think we can know that. I think, for one thing, the reasons that Roy Moore was controversial before these allegations came out, which are more than just that, you know, he's against abortion and same-sex marriage. He has views that go much further than that, right? Believing that Muslims should not be allowed to serve in Congress, and that homosexual acts should be illegal. A lot of views that, based on my experience of Alabama, it's a very red state, but the kind of Republicans who either stayed home or wrote in another candidate or couldn't bring themselves to vote for Roy Moore are the ones for whom those are not the reasons that they're with the Republican Party. They're with the Republican Party because they believe they're stewards of the economy and good on taxes and fiscal discipline. And those kind of Republicans are sort of alienated by all of these hard right appeals. And so if the campaign had been focused on those issues, I don't think we know how well Roy Moore might have done. I mean, as you mentioned, so much of this is about the credibility of the mainstream media. And Roy Moore, borrowing from the Trump playbook, just said, you know, not only are all of these women who didn't know each other and have come forward independently, not only are they all lying, it's a conspiracy against me, it's all a setup. And almost all of the people who decided to vote for Roy Moore believed that. They did not think that the allegations were true. They were convinced. And with so many voters these days living in a media bubble where they only consume the media that affirms their sort of side of any issue, I think that that's an ongoing issue in our politics. But I would say one last thing about this issue set of polarizing cultural issues that Trump has been so skillful at deploying and that Moore talked about and used in his campaign. We also saw that in the Virginia race, right? You had, maybe not as the main theme of the campaign, but the Republican candidate Ed Gillespie trying to motivate the Trump base by sending out messages and mailers talking about preserving Confederate statues and stopping sanctuary cities and Hispanic gangs. And those dastardly kneeling football players in the NFL and these felons who are registering to vote. And even if what happened was, even if people agreed with him about those issues, it just wasn't their top priority.
Right. Okay.
People's top priority was health care. And there was an exit poll that showed that actually a large majority agreed with Ed Gillespie's stand on the Confederate statues. They still didn't vote for him because it just wasn't what they thought was the most important issue.
Karen Tumulty, I want you to react to a statement from National Republican Senatorial Committee Chairman Cory Gardner, Senator from Colorado, after the Moore defeat. He said, tonight's results are clear. The people of Alabama deemed Roy Moore unfit to serve in the U.S. Senate. I hope Senator-elect Doug Jones will do the right thing and represent Alabama by choosing to vote with the Republican Party. Of course, Trump considered Jones a puppet for Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi. What do you expect will be his role, Doug Jones' role in the Congress going forward? Will he be more of a sort of a conservative Democrat in line with Alabama politics, or will he be a puppet for Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi?
Well, he has been sort of vague on some of the issue questions that have been put to him. But it does suggest, you know, the politics of the state suggests that he is going to have a pretty conservative voting record just to survive. And you see people like Senator Manchin of West Virginia saying he's looking forward to seeing him so he won't feel like he's such a lonely conservative Democrat. I think especially on economic issues, there's going to be a lot of pressure on him to vote in sort of conservative and moderate ways.
Yeah. Let's sort of move forward to the big issue today in Congress, and that's the prospects for a major, major tax bill, the most sweeping tax changes since 1986. There is now, Jack Beatty, a joint House-Senate proposal, but it hasn't passed the Senate yet. The latest is that Senator Marco Rubio is not sure he's happy with it because he's concerned about the tax credit for child care. What do you see now as the prospects of the Republicans getting this tax bill passed into the president before Christmas, which is what their objective is?
Well, the pressure is on them from their donors, but it's not on them from sort of the wider public. According to a study, this tax bill, which is a tax cut, is the, quote, most disliked piece of major domestic legislation of the past quarter century. And its only competitor in that regard seems to be the effort to repeal Obamacare. How the Republicans have managed to take something that should be universally popular, a tax cut, and made it so unpopular. Well, it's a study, really, of how the bubble that we heard about, you know, the people within their information bubble, sometimes that breaks down, and sometimes people get the picture. And the picture on this one is it's a big tax cut for corporations, for rich people, and maybe something for the middle class. And Marco Rubio reminds us of the tax cut that could have been generous to people who don't pay, the 47% of Americans who don't pay income tax, perhaps even moving to a payroll tax cut. That's the direction that really the Trump campaign promised, but it's not what the Republican campaign bill is delivering.
Well, Jack, I have to tell you that President Trump does not agree with you. He tweeted this week, as a candidate, I promised we would pass a massive tax cut for the everyday working Americans. If you make your voices heard, this moment will be forever remembered as a great new beginning, the dawn of a brilliant American future shining with patriotism, prosperity, and pride. President Trump is never one given to understatement, and he has very high expectations for this. I don't think we're going to have time for going to a call before the break, but quickly, Karen Tumulty, as a national political reporter, a very quick assessment from you of where this bill stands right now and its prospects for passage.
Well, at this point, they are, you know, if Marco Rubio stays where he says he is right now, they're just one Republican defection away from not being able to pass this bill.
This is On Point. I'm Tom Gelton. In other news this week, yesterday marked the 5-year anniversary of the tragic Sandy Hook Elementary School shooting. Church bells in Newtown, Connecticut chimed 26 times yesterday morning, commemorating the 26 lives lost. And White House staffer Omarosa Manigault Newman refuted reports she was fired by John Kelly this week, asserting she'd actually resigned. She appeared on Good Morning America yesterday.
As the only African-American woman in this White House, as a senior staff and assistant to the president, I have seen things that have made me uncomfortable, that have upset me, that have affected me deeply and emotionally.
And the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame 2018 inductees are out, and Bon Jovi is on the list. Here's their 1986 Bon Jovi hit, You Give Love a Bad Name.
Shot through the heart, and you're to blame, darling. You give love a bad name.
See, we don't just do hard news here. You can join our conversation. Is the deal between 21st Century Fox and Disney going to change entertainment and how we consume it? Follow us on Twitter, and you can find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. And we are talking about this week's news with Karen Tumulty of The Washington Post, Molly Ball of Time Magazine, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. Karen, I kind of cut you off short a little bit just before the break. Let's just finish up this dissection of the tax bill as it stands right now. There were a number of issues that divided the House and Senate conferees on this bill, mortgage deductions, the top rate, provisions for taxing tuition waivers for graduate students. How were those differences resolved in the final version?
Well, the big news in the final version was an additional cut in the top rate in corporate taxes. I mean, at the top rate of income taxes. And I think that, you know, at this point, the pressure is so intense to get something through that that those issues are probably going to be, you know, falling by the wayside as the political pressure really builds up.
You know, speaking at a news conference yesterday, House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi says the Republican tax bill is unpopular with voters.
I think they're in a lose-lose situation. If they don't pass the bill, they lose because you know what they've said about their donors are not going to answer their calls anymore if they don't pass the bill. So they lose in that regard. If they do pass the bill, they'll lose in the court of public opinion.
Well, speaking of the court of public opinion, we have our own court of public opinion among On Point listeners. Tyler is calling from Orlando, Florida. Tyler, thanks for calling On Point.
Hi, Tom.
What's your sense of the tax bill as it now stands, the proposals from the Republican leadership?
I would say that I have a hard time seeing them become law. Republicans haven't actually been in a position of governing since 2007. The vast majority of the Republican caucus in the Senate and the House has been elected and has served in a time when, you know, it didn't really matter what they voted on because President Obama was going to veto it. They could have, even when they controlled Congress, they could put forward whatever bills they wanted and they could pass them, but they were sort of rest assured that President Obama was going to veto them. Now that they actually have control, I mean, I don't think that most of them know how to govern. The House leadership certainly doesn't know how to govern. So I think that this is the first time in their congressional careers that they've actually had to vote on something that could very well become law, or the second time if you include the proposed health care repeal. And, you know, that's why I think it's ultimately going to fail, that they know that it's a bad bill, and this is the first time that they've actually done anything with consequence.
Yeah. Well, Jack Beatty, you made the point before that Republicans may be caught between sort of public opinion and the opinion of donors. I suppose we're going to see how they balance those two considerations. But I want at this point, Jack, to move on to another story. The Washington Post this morning has a really remarkable long story about how President Trump has consistently sort of dismissed or disregarded the advice, the intelligence of his own intelligence community regarding Russia. I'm assuming you saw that story. What do you make of it?
Well, it's a shocking story, a thickly reported story, and everyone should read it. It essentially shows a president who, even when being briefed by the CIA although I would think that Mr. Pompeo finds a way to do this, he doesn't want to hear about Russia. Well, Russia is one of our main adversaries in the world, certainly in regions of the world, but he will not even hear of it. And the line that comes through this piece, not from the Post reporters, but from White House sources, is that the president is neuralgic on Russia because it feels like it's derogating his election victory. I won the victory on the basis of my great campaign, my charisma, that, and my issues. And don't raise Russia. You're trying to delegitimize my election. Well, that sounds right. For a highly insecure man, that fits our picture, our sort of psychological profile of Trump. But so does something else. That all this, aversion to talking about Russia or even hearing the word, is because he has a guilty conscience. Is because he knows his campaign, and I'm just hypothesizing, had illicit contacts with Russia, and that that's what's driving this behavior, not a feeling about the election. We don't know.
We don't know. And I should point out, we should consider that it's not just President Trump, to some extent, that has this view. A recent poll from Quinnipiac University found that remarkable split between the way Republicans view the issue of Russian meddling in the election and the way Democrats view it. 50% of Republicans do think the Kremlin tried to influence the election. Meanwhile, 94% of Democrats think that Russia tried to meddle in the election. Molly Ball, this is really something, it seems to me, that's almost unprecedented in American politics. I mean, for as long as I've been alive, and I've been alive a long time, Russia has been considered an adversary by people across the political spectrum. How do we explain this huge split between Democrats and Republicans on their view of Russia?
Well, I have to go back to that partisan echo chamber that we've been talking about, because one of the things that we've seen, especially lately, is a steady drumbeat of right-leaning media attempting to discredit the investigation. It is practically the only topic you hear about in the primetime Fox News shows. The Wall Street Journal has run a series of opinion pieces and editorials talking about the problems with the investigation. There's clearly been a concerted decision to not let this lie and to take the president's view, basically, which is that this is a conspiracy against him and a witch hunt and so on, and that's going to sway a lot of people. I don't think that's the only reason, right? The inherent partisan tribalism of our times has a lot to do with it. But when the thing that people want to believe, the thing that makes them feel better to believe because it doesn't disturb their worldview, is the thing that they hear reinforced over and over, or they can find that information so easily online, it tends to harden those perceptions.
And Karen Tumulty, as Molly suggested, many Republicans are trying to shift the focus here away from President Trump and away from Russia and onto the investigation itself. And again, you know, in what seems to me to be almost an unprecedented development, we see the FBI coming in for very intense criticism. One of the clips that caught my attention this week on Fox News was from the Judicial Watch president. Of course, Judicial Watch is a conservative organization. But he said, forget about the FBI investigation into Clinton and Trump being compromised. I think the FBI's been compromised. Forget about shutting down Mr. Mueller, Robert Mueller, the FBI director. We need to shut down the FBI, maybe because it was turned into a KGB-type operation by the Obama administration. The FBI is a KGB operation?
Yeah, it's really extraordinary. And, at this point, the most recent smoking gun in this view is some text messages between a couple of people who were expressing support for Hillary Clinton and, and opposition to Donald Trump while they were working on the Clinton investigation. The fact that these people, one of them was dispatched when these texts came to light would suggest that they were, in fact, policing their own investigators. But this is seen as evidence, put through a certain prism, it's seen as evidence that it's another – that the FBI is just yet another arm of the deep state.
Well, Karen, what do you think are the prospects for, you know, a second special counsel investigation of the investigation or of the FBI or of these suspect FBI agents? I mean, there's a lot of talk about it. Do you see any likelihood it could happen?
I don't. I mean, I think that the fact that Rod Rosenstein, who is the number two person at the Justice Department, testified on the Hill this week and expressed great confidence in Robert Mueller and the professionalism of his investigation and the professionalism of his investigators, I think suggests that, you know, the what you would need for this to happen would be for the Justice Department to move and declare this investigation. This is not something that happens because a bunch of people on Capitol Hill want to see it happen.
Right. In fact, New York Congressman Gerald Nadler asked Rosenstein directly if he saw cause to fire him, and he said no. And he said, if there were good cause, I would act. If there were not good cause, I would not. And he says he does not see good cause to fire him right now. Actually, let's go to Craig, who's on the line from Wisconsin, from Onalaska, Wisconsin. And Craig, thanks for calling On Point.
Hi, Tom. After hearing about Trump's refusal to hear anything about the Russian interference, I'm of the opinion that he is in violation of his oath of office, which says in part that he is to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States. By refusing to hear anything about Russia, he is not doing his job.
And, you know, before we drop this, I want to read something here. This is those of you who don't know Robert Mueller's background may not know that he's a former Marine, won a Bronze Star in Vietnam. His citation read that with complete disregard for his own safety, he personally led a fire team across the fire-swept terrain to recover a mortally wounded Marine who had fallen forward of the friendly lines. So, you know, we sometimes get swept up in accusations and criticisms, but I think when you have a figure like Robert Mueller in the news, it's important to keep in mind the service that he has employed on the part of America. Let's move on now to another big story in the news, and some people would even argue that it is the biggest story of the week, and that is the decision by the FCC to repeal net neutrality, a very important policy move by the Obama administration. Jack Beatty, how important do you think this FCC move was?
Well, a lot of it is above my pay grade. I did watch some of it, the hearings and so on. One thing I was struck with, and this comes from Attorney General Schneiderman of New York. He claims that during the public comment period, which about this decision, which began in May and has run to the present, during this period, there were, I don't know, I think he said there were 13 million people responded to this. You know, what do you think about this? And he says of that 13 million, a large part were, in fact, somehow ginned up fake input, fake public opinion. I don't know what basis. He says he has evidence. He says he's going to challenge this decision going to court on that. But that was something I just heard him say last night, and that could be highly, highly significant. The thing that I'm struck with is just how innocent these big companies sound. Comcast, for example, which is the largest cable company, which stands to benefit greatly here, they say, we promise we're not going to, you know, create a fast lane from a slow lane. We're not going to do anything. Mm-hmm. You have our promise. Imagine taking the promise in 1911 of Standard Oil. Oh, we're not going to do anything like that. It's strange credulity that a great company without any constraint on it would not abuse its market power.
Well, Molly Ball, I think you're the youngest of all of us here today, and I'm going to ask you to speak on behalf of a younger generation. I saw an amazing finding this week that no other issue is going to affect the 18 to 34 vote like this repeal of net neutrality. Do you think that among, let's say, millennials, this is that important an issue?
Well, I've unfortunately aged out of that demographic, but you do see a lot of there was this issue with the fake comments, but there's also an outpouring of real comments on this issue. It is a highly motivating issue for, you know, young tech savvy people who have been there. You're seeing really a lot of activism on what might seem like a sort of highly technical and even mundane issue. I mean, to me, the issue that's highlighted by this change is how much effect the Trump administration is having on rules and regulations through deregulation and the regulatory process. There's been a lot of talk about how, you know, Trump's not getting anything through Congress. He's not able to pass major legislation, but he is having a very large effect on all kinds of areas of American life through this deregulatory push on behalf of the cabinet and commissions like the FCC, the EPA, the Department of Education, all over government. You see regulations being rolled back or regulations made by Obama being undone or changed. This was a regulation that the Obama administration's FCC had put in place and that the Trump head of the FCC now is overturning. And, you know, I think conservatives would tell you that it was Obama who overreached by, when he couldn't get things through Congress, using the regulatory apparatus to push through a lot of the policy changes that he favored. And now Trump is undoing that wholesale.
In fact, there was he staged a photo op in the White House this week with stacks and stacks and stacks of regulations that he was very proud of canceling. Okay, there was a couple stories we didn't get to having to do with this. One is the Disney-Fox merger, and that could have a lot of implications. We'll have to take that up in another hour. We're also going to get back to the Russia story next week here on the On Point program. I want to thank my guests for joining us today, Karen Tumulty, national political correspondent for The Washington Post. Karen, thank you again for being with us.
Great to be here.
And Molly Ball from Time Magazine, great to have you with us.
Thank you, Tom.
And Jack Beatty, thank you once again. Have a great weekend, Jack.
Thank you, Tom.
You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. You can follow us on Twitter. You can find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Coming up Monday, the FBI and the Russia investigation. I'm Tom Gelton. This is On Point.